and not to give up or to give in, not to fall for modern metaphysics, which is a worse one, namely the pseudo-scientific metaphysics, which tries to tell us what we must do according to the iron laws of history or the iron laws of nature, making us automatons, not to fall back into some belief that makes us happy, namely the belief in a higher proposition of eternity or immortality in the religious way, because we would use this only to make ourselves happy. We would use it for psychological motives, not for motives of real belief. We would be fakers. So it seems that only the third way is open, though it is the hardest way, and this way has to be gone. Now in Socrates himself, in his position, in the Greek world of his time, we have already a situation that seems strangely familiar. Socrates was poisoned or killed by his fellow citizens because they believed that he was somebody else. They, even if we want to give historical justice, to render historical justice, they almost could not help to believe that he was somebody else. He was so easily to be mixed up with a new trend of thinking that came up in his time, which he bitterly fought, but was forced to use the logical means developed by this trend of thinking, the sophists. So when he was judged, there seemed to be two positions that everybody thought he knew in the Greek world at that time. The first position was that one obeys the gods, that the life of man is regulated by an absolute, this absolute not in the Hebrew or Christian sense revealed, but this absolute given by tradition in the Athenian laws, a tradition that apparently went back in belief to the gods. Athena herself who had given those laws to Athens. The education was based on this belief, and they did not know that this whole thing had become a fake, that they had made out of the polis, of the community of Athens, not a democracy but an ochlocracy, the rule of the multitude, that Athens was going to go down hopelessly, that all those old propositions had become a lie, an ambiguity. They wanted to believe that they still hold. And there were the others, the sophists, who knew that they couldn't hold, and who did not believe in those propositions anymore. And the greatest of them, Protagoras, who said, man is the measure of all things, of the being ones that they are, and of the non-being ones that they are not. Man is the measure of all things. As to the gods, I do not know if they exist or not. This is a position of the sophists. This position sounds very much like Socrates' position, namely as to the gods. Socrates never claimed to know the gods. He even showed, as Kant, that we possibly cannot know anything about the gods. Yet he did not deny the gods. Protagoras and the other sophists especially, more than he, denied the gods. Man is a measure of all things. This is the root of humanism. Of humanism as a metaphysics. Because humanism is a metaphysics. Humanism is something we have to look critically at too. The root of humanism in Protagoras, and this is the first, so to speak, black buccaneer flag of humanism that is raised here, this Protagoras, who was one of the greatest thinkers of Greek time. If man is the measure of all things, who is man? Man does not exist. All men are men. If man is the measure of all things, then you and I and you and you and I, we all by ourselves, everybody for himself, is the measure of all things. That means we fall into an absolute relativism. The final decision is made by the strongest one. It becomes a question of mere power. If we all are absolutes, man is the absolute, it means that we all are absolutes, everybody of us. If we all are absolutes, we will come into a ceaseless fight against each other. We will use the wrong logic, which is the logic of not convincing another one, but making him mute, making him give in. This logic will finally be replaced by the weapons of terror, because they are the best arguments of the wrong logic. And one will govern, or nobody will govern. The multitude will govern in an apparatus. That is the end of humanism. The start of humanism is the claim that the absolute that is in the gods, as the old Greek system said, can be replaced by the absolute as residing in man. So Socrates was in between. He did not think that man was an absolute. Nor did he make use of an absolute that the gods were supposed to be, because he said, I do not know about the gods. So I cannot use them as an argument. He must have had in view another relation to an absolute, which might be a relative relation of men to some absolute. His student Plato really gave in to the enemies of Socrates, because he later said against Protagoras, the measure of all things is not man, the measure of all things is God. No, not gods, but God. By that he did not mean Jehovah, the one God. He meant divinity, the principle of divinity, the idea of God. With that he placed himself against the Socratic position, because Socrates had never claimed such a thing of higher ideas of godly origin that govern the life of man. He was not a metaphysician. So we have three positions here, which are strangely familiar. If we replace now the old Greek position by the Platonic position, because it is a sharper one and the better one, and has been become the foundation of our best, one of the great foundations of our Western culture, then we would have what we have today. We have it only in a very diluted form. Namely, on one hand, the proposition, nature is the measure of all things, and since man is, so to speak, the finest product of nature, so man, of course, is the measure of all things. And he has only to follow his own nature and the laws of his own nature, and the laws of nature, and the laws of history, which he can discover, being the absolute judge. He is a measure. And that leads us straight into totalitarianism. This is what I call naturalism as a metaphysics. And we have again supernaturalism as a metaphysics, namely all those people who come to us and say, well, there's only one help, back to Thomas Aquinas. But Thomas Aquinas is Augustine and is Aristotle and is Plato. They have the same basic position. So we are back, philosophically. Not back. We are still in the same predicament. We haven't made any progress. If we cut through all of those terms that those opposites have been termed, naturalism and supernatural have been termed, materialism and idealism, realism and romanticism and classicism and what you want through the ages, it always amounted to the same thing, namely to the same basic proposition, either. You believe in an absolute that is transcendent, God, or ideas, eternal ideas, and then you might perhaps have a little freedom, namely the freedom of choice between good and evil. Things will not go entirely worse, but this will set a limit to reason which the philosophers do not intend to set. We won't also set a limit to reason, but we want to find out what this limit is and not have this limit set, namely being told that in certain questions you just have to stop to think and have to believe. We don't want to bring reason as a sacrifice. And every religion or every supernaturalistic philosophy asks of us to bring reason as a sacrifice, to sacrifice reason at a certain point. We don't like that proposition. The others ask the entire sacrifice of reason too, because they say there's no reason at all, there's only intellect. You can be a clever guy, and that means you can really look into the laws of nature and history and of man, so to speak, who is the judge of all things and the measure, and you can find them out, and then you will have found out what you have to do, what you must do anyhow. So you can find out that you are an automaton, which is thoroughly conditioned. That is the freedom they propose to us. The one is not enough, the other kind of freedom is nothing, is the opposite of freedom. Both propositions are not entirely satisfactory. And that is the reason why we try now to ask people who did not place themselves into that predicament. People who have not been, and the pre-Platonic thinkers in Greek, for instance, we have to look critically at too. There happened a terrible thing to our friend Heidegger. He was one of the best modern philosophers who saw first we have to go back to pre-Platonic thinking. So he started to unearth, so to speak, the sense of the archaic Greek language. He's the greatest Greek philologist on the sideline that lives. He found the original meaning of those things. But he believed that all pre-Platonic thinkers have been out of this metaphysical condition of being either naturalistic or supernaturalistic. He believed in them. He started to interpret them, those are all masterpieces of interpretation, and finally we find that he had helped, again, to develop metaphysics. Because he has not become aware that all the so-called naturalist Greek thinkers before Plato or before Socrates have also been metaphysicians, namely naturalist metaphysicians, and that Plato is only the opposite pole of them. That's the development of metaphysical thinking started in Greece and in very early time with Thales and Anaximander. And that there's only one, except Socrates, who takes not a metaphysical position, that's Heraclitus. So that is the reason why, for this cause, of the Greek thinkers, only Heraclitus and Socrates have been chosen, because they can give us their credentials. They can show to us that they didn't believe in any such thing as the absolute nature or the absolute divinity. They were neither naturalists nor supernaturalists, and they were the only ones. So after this long process of digging into that kind of a past that has been forgotten, we finally have a point in a few thinkers where we might be able to compare to our own situation, and from whom we might be able to learn. This account I have given to you in order to put you into the picture as to the most modern development, and here you have the connection. Since Kant's great deed, namely involuntarily to blow up the foundation of certainty that was underlying all our speculative thinking in the West, since then, with Marx, Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, thinkers have come who were again forced, and forced themselves, into a basic condition of absolute uncertainty. Most of them failed, finally, because they thought they could build, now after having been so critical, their own metaphysics. So Marx fell into positivism and became a naturalist metaphysician of the first order. Even Nietzsche slipped in his old age and thought that in the will to power he had discovered the principle, the absolute principle of being. And now we have it. Now we have the truth in our left hand, so to speak, and won't let go, and we can explain everything by this absolute truth that we have in our hand. He did not only die in insanity, he died in illusion. So did Marx. So did Kierkegaard. When Kierkegaard had started out to question everything again afresh, and not believing in those fake assumptions and propositions, finally, in his despair, he did not see any other help but to jump into absolute belief and to say, there is nothing to reason whatsoever. It only misleads man. There's only one help, and that is absolute belief in God. But God had become identical with nothingness by his thinking. He asked us to believe in a God that is nothing, that is identical with nothingness, falling into nihilism and becoming a religious metaphysician in the end was his faith. So every one of the three great ones that opened the new inquiry finally fell back into the old predicament. So hard it is, or seems to be, to make steps into an entirely new land of thinking. Nietzsche started out by being the anti-Plato. He wanted to be it consciously. Well, we see many anti-communists today, and the trouble with them seems to be that they are too much communists, namely in their methods. Anti is no position. If one does not know one's pro, and one remains anti, then one falls into the trap to use the methods of the enemy. Anti-metaphysics is metaphysical too. Anti-communism is communism too. What we need is a legitimation. What are you for? Not what are you against? The against You have to show me from you what you are for. Then I will believe that you are against and you are anti is productive. Otherwise it can be entirely negative and even help the enemy. But sometimes in times of emergency, those are all tragic situations of human life, one has to be that way. And Nietzsche, for instance, saw no help than to proceed on the line of anti-Platonism. Finally, he was a Platonist himself again. But he had opened the way. It was a heroic deed. He had consciously fought against that position and had loosened up it tremendously and brought forth new propositions that are for us very, very helpful. So all of the three great thinkers in the 19th century, the three new great thinkers. Hegel might have been a greater mind, but he was an old thinker. He was a metaphysician from the beginning. But those three are tragic figures. They all met finally a fake position and knew it and really had discovered nihilism. With them, nihilism starts as a philosophical position, and we are all in that predicament. So we have first to find, and now we want to connect in the next session, when we go into this question, what has gone wrong with our relation to time and to eternity? Then we might find the connection to what nothingness in our time means, and why nothingness or nihilism, and I do not mean that nihilism anything, I mean as it is used today, namely people who want to destroy and so on, all that nonsense. I mean a philosophical position. This philosophical position has been formulated by Friedrich Nietzsche. Nothing is true. Everything is permitted. That is the position of philosophical nihilism. The statement that nothing is true and everything is permitted. Because man cannot find any truths, therefore nothing can be true. Man is the measure of all things. Keep that in mind. And man cannot find any real law, therefore he cannot bind himself and everything is permitted. That is the underlying conviction of most people of our time, even when they claim to be believers. Or it is the practice they use, let alone what they say. Most of the people of our time have been driven into that nihilistic position. So we will look at the people who formulated it and did not want to use it. Because the same Nietzsche who said that might be the case, he could write about himself, well, I have destroyed all foundations of morals because I have found no real true reason for anything like morals. We do not have a leg to stand on. We are ambiguous when we talk about morals because we do not have real reason for it, so I have destroyed these foundations. Everything is permitted. Who is saying that? Me? Could I commit a murder? A murder, he writes. One little broken promise of mine. And long suffering and final death will be my fate. That is how the man was. That means one of the greatest moral personalities that ever lived. This critic of morals, of the foundations of morals. He drove himself into that absolute contradiction that must drive him insane. That he, being born by instinct, by heart, a highly developed moral personality, nevertheless as a philosopher couldn't find any moral reason that has been put forward in all Western philosophers which he could not finally show that it was a conscious life brought up by a will to power by certain intellectuals or priests. He demasks them all as propositions of power over other men. So the question, is moral at all possible? And what is moral? Is there any foundation of ethics, or is there none? If we leave God out, as soon as we believe in God, everything's fine, everything's all right. But if we are thinking merely in secular terms, then we have to show what that is, morals, and where the foundation of it really is. And he tried, and he failed. Others have tried, others have failed. Because Camus, one of the most serious modern philosophers, so he is a very narrow man, he's not a great mind, but he's one of the most sincere and profound thinkers, and most realistic. He says, in all philosophy, we have not yet been able to discover a reason why a man should not murder. Not a reason. We live by ethical pronunciations, we live by higher commands, we live by instincts, we don't do it. But there's no reason to be found. If there is no reason that could prevent us from murder, and we do not go back to religion, we might be in for a fine time. And we are in for a fine time, because as soon as we cannot find a reason, a real reason, out of human reason, against murder, then we will start to find infinite reasons for murder. So infinite reasons and so fantastic reasons, in which lots of people will believe when we tell them those reasons. And Hitler told them why he will slaughter 5 million Jews, and he did. And there was a great part of humanity, and not only in Germany, who believed those reasons, that they had to be liquidated. And this credulity, that we start to believe suddenly in reasons brought forward for murder, those people have to be wiped out. Now this group has to be wiped out. There are always good reasons for it. As soon as the foundation reason against murder, namely thou shalt not kill, is not there anymore. Because either God has gone, who gave that as a command, and we have in vain tried. Now, since we don't have the command anymore, yeah, or we pretend to believe in the command, look how we perform. We are compelled to find, by human reason, a fundament for not murdering, that everybody can understand, that can be an argument that nobody can refute. By his own reason, that we have not yet fulfilled, as Camus said, and as Nietzsche said before him. This is one of our purposes here. Because if we do not find that human reason, limited as it might be, is able to conduct the behavior of free men, then we better throw human reason overboard and go back into religious belief, and in a hurry, because otherwise we will find ourselves murdering each other in a short time all over the world, because the reasons for murder grow, and they grow permanently, and they become more and more convincing. That is the main danger of our time. So we have bitten off a big thing when in the Enlightenment of the 18th century we claimed that man can now take care of himself merely by human reason. Can we? So we have to ask the question again, can we? What is human reason? Who is man? How far does it reach with its limits? What can it do? What can it not do? So we will say, we open, reopen the discussion with the theologians and the religious people, as well with those positivists and naturalists again. Either we find another position or we have to give in.